We're in the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, Oregon. This is the 32nd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society. Cognition in Flux is the title, with Arvind Joshi, who is professor of computer and cognitive science at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is also the 10th symposium honoring 10 years of the Rummelhart Prize. And you are indeed a former Rummelhart Prize winner for 2003. And we'll get to the questions that you're going to talk about in the symposium in a minute. But it'd be really interesting to get some sense of how your work fits into the field of cognitive science, especially for a general audience. Because I think as soon as you think about mathematical linguistics, I think most people sitting at home would think that linguistics is linguistics. What's mathematical about it? So could you do a sort of idiot's guide, a 101 to what this field is about?
Yeah, well, with respect to my background, I'm in computer science and in linguistics. So I have a joint appointment. And one of my major interests is to provide computational models of language at various levels. And of course, the grammar is the easiest place to understand why a computational model might have a chance to work, because there are set of rules that have to be applied in some order or whatever. So that's where I got interested in the early days of 1958-59. With Professor Harris, who was Chomsky's professor actually at Penn. And so we built a sort of a finite state machine to take texts from, they were really physiology text, biology texts, and actually parse the sentences, analyze them. Parse means to provide a syntactic structure, with the idea that eventually that analysis would be used for making some kind of analysis of the text. So that's how I got into the field, but then I got very much interested in the mathematical computational modeling of the syntactic aspects to start with. And around that time, Noam Chomsky had also introduced a hierarchy of different formalisms, especially context-free grammars, transformational grammars, whose goal was to sort of mathematically characterize some linguistic structures. Of course, from anybody coming from computational background, this is a very good place to start, get hold of. Now the field, the linguistic field itself, especially Chomsky's, has really gone away from the mathematical aspects. Not because he has abandoned it, but he says it's too early, which I don't understand what that means. He's not interested, let's put it that way. But many of the people in that era, like me, we know we did a lot of interesting work, and one of the aspects that still continues to interest me is to find out what is the minimal mathematical structure or power we need to describe language. By language, I mean any language, not English. Mm-hmm. On the assumption that there is such a restricted device of some kind. So that's been one of my major field of research and contribution, to identify, not exactly, but at least limit the space in which we can search for such a optimal structure. Optimal from the point of view of syntactic characterization. There are many other aspects of language. So that's where I sort of made one of my major contributions.
So you were born in India originally, right?
Yeah.
So how long had you been in the United States by
1958? Oh, I came in 1954 as a graduate student.
So yeah, just 4 years later you were...
Yeah. So we wrote this finite state program. If it was Harris, we wrote that. I mean, we means there was a group of people. I was one of them in 1958. Then I finished my PhD in 60. And then I didn't know what I was going to do. But another project in this kind of work sort of came along. So both the departments, computer science and linguistics, offered me faculty position. So I said, fine, that's quite an ideal situation. So since then, I've been, yeah.
The work that you started doing, how does it now fit into, I mean, we're talking about a meeting where it's called Cognition in Flux.
Yeah. Well, it fits in my mind. I mean, there's a big gap. We all agree that there are all kinds of constraints in language at various levels. And we know from the linguistic research in the last 50, 60 years that these constraints are not arbitrary. Many of them hold across all languages. And if there is any variation, it's really variation of some parameters instead of just completely new rules. I mean, that's so it appears that there is a system of constraints that seem to be operating at the linguistic level. And of course, each particular language will pick on certain ones of these, and another language will pick some others. But underlyingly, it's the same space that's being exploited. So the question arises, of course, you can study this empirically by actually observing the data, which is what linguists do. And that's where I look at the data and see what I see there. But then there is a sort of a computational slash mathematical perspective, mm-hmm. as to can we characterize the space of these constraints in some mathematical, abstract, computational way? Because to the extent we can, then we can give a computational account of the linguistic machinery. So that's the, that's the assumption. That's the working assumption. Mm-hmm. And I think there is enough evidence to suggest. Now, we have long ways to connect this to how the brain actually implements this and so on. You know, people are, of course, exploring it in morphology, as you must have heard from Paul. There is a lot of work being done, but that's only a small piece of the language apparatus.
Do you find that you are nevertheless engaged in debates about these larger issues of innateness and so on, about Chomsky's language?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you definitely engage into it, whether how it affects your everyday work is another question. But yes, those are important issues. I mean, can be, we don't know really the answer. I mean, we can sort of, each person is assuming certain hypotheses. But I think based on what we know now, it's fairly clear, seems to be fairly clear, that it's not an arbitrary space that is exploited by different individual languages. It's some common machinery, and constrained machinery is being exploited for language, and each language is picking up different aspects of it. I don't work in acquisition per se, okay? So I don't want to sound like an expert in that area. I have my colleagues who work on it. But that's one of the assumptions that is behind why the kids can acquire language so fast. Because all they need to identify certain pieces of information and they can abstract from that. But underlying there is an assumption that there is a shared common structure.
Yeah, the reason I ask is that as I think about the range that cognitive science now covers, how it's expanded over the last decades, how much interdisciplinary work there is, and how what's being talked about here impacts people's everyday lives, the kind of people that the New York Times, Science Times, or whatever. You know, and what they see in general about language would be books like, I don't know, Steve Pinker, The Language Instinct, sure, and so on. And at the same time, they're raising children and watching children and seeing when they start talking and wondering if there is a critical period for acquisition of language, and why do they learn foreign languages so much easier when they're young. So there are these practical, pragmatic issues that they say on a day-to-day basis. And I think it'd be very interesting to try and convey more of the underpinnings, the theoretical underpinnings of this stuff, so that people have more of a grounding in it. So that's why I'm navigating this way.
So I think to the extent we can identify these constraints computationally and formally, then we have some account of why the language might be easily acquired, because you sort of have that built into you in some sense, although you don't know the exact parameters that which you have to learn from the experience. Now, coming from computational side, there is a big revolution taking place, namely how you acquire linguistic models from just data. This is, of course, printed material, texts, and huge amounts of text we can now explore computationally. And so one group of people think that we can, even, hundreds of millions of words of text, we should be able to extract the linguistic structure by doing statistical analysis. So that's the extreme case where they would not assume any a priori structure. I don't think that quite works. You can get some of the structure out, obviously, word frequencies and, bigrams, trigrams, but not really significant amount of syntactic structure. On the other hand, it turns out that if you provide a little bit of structural information, then you can begin to extract a lot of structure from the corpus. To give an example, if you provide the what are known as closed clauses, in English they will be like articles, the words indefinite article, definite article, prepositions. So these are parts of speech that are closed clauses, means you don't add new items to this class every day. They're sort of fairly fixed. Mm-hmm. They may change over hundreds of years, but otherwise they are fixed. So if you give the machine this much information that these are closed class items, and you name them what they are, then you can acquire other categories like nouns and verbs by just looking at vast amounts of data. Mm-hmm. So this kind of work is going on the computational linguistic side. People there are not interested how your mind works. They just want to see how much you can extract from the corpus.
So this may be a naive question, forgive me if it is, but when I see the improvement in voice recognition apparatuses and voices playing back, this is all
exactly
in
it's connected. Yeah, the speech people are of course interested in
patterns.
I don't work directly in speech, so I'm giving you examples from texts.
Right.
What you can do from text. So there is this other piece of research which says there is some kind of weak supervision, namely if I've given a little bit of information from outside, that was not learned from the corpus.
Right.
Then I can extract a lot of other interesting syntactic categories and structural information. And so lots of people, including me, we work on how much of information can we extract if I give you a little bit to start off, independently how the mind works, So we have interest in this because this has of course practical applications, obviously. But on the theoretical side, it's also of interest. Now we know that the child is not exposed to vast amounts of data like that. So it's not going to explain child language acquisition, but it might explain how we can acquire the same linguistic structures by observing vast amounts of data.
Could you sort of explain the notions of supervised and unsupervised
learning? Well, supervised means I will give you a certain amount of text, and I will give you the complete syntactic analysis of each sentence on that text. And then you learn from that the syntactic structure, and then you check it on unseen material, how well it works. So that is called supervised because I gave you the fully analyzed texts.
A cheat sheet.
But it's not ruled out, because that means I've shown you many, many examples, and then see you can learn. It turns out that that helps, but it still doesn't work that well. I mean, you would need lots of analyzed data, and that's expensive to create millions of words of analyzed data, because somebody has to sit down and, you know, and then you don't know how reliable it is and all that. So people want to find out other ways of going around this problem by saying, if I give you a little bit of data of a certain kind, which is not hard to find, like, you know, I can tell you all the articles and all these close classed items in these texts, easy to identify. But if I give you those, then, and ask you, well, how much can you do now? Can you identify which are nouns, which are verbs? And it turns out that you can, to a large extent. It has an independent interest. Then, of course, once these techniques succeed, the people who work in acquisition and from the, they're also interested. They said, well, maybe the child is picking up simple cues like this initially, but we don't know why it would pick those up and not some others. Mm-hmm. But assuming they pick those up, then they will acquire the other parts of the structure much more easily and faster. So eventually there may be connections in these two directions of research. But right now I like to sort of think of them as independently motivated enterprises. But many cognitive scientists are also getting interested in this, because they are interested in how much can you extract from vast amounts of data, which is becoming, you know, as you know, becoming available, which was not available before. So our bias towards immediately abstracting things might be partly due to the fact that we didn't really have access to vast amounts of information, but now we have. Now we have computational tools. Right. So the possibility arises so that maybe we can extract a lot from. But I like to think of these as two different activities, because otherwise you can confuse the goals. You know, they're not quite the same goals.
And in what sense does the work in parallel distributed processing, in connectionism?
Yeah, well, the parallel distributed processing was a particular architecture of processing was proposed. That is more of a, it's like saying that there is some kind of structure that's already, I know, exists in your brain for some reason. It's not induced from the observed data. It's an hypothesis in that sense. And then you check to see how you would use that kind of structure to analyze or categorize things around the world, which is what you heard yesterday. So I don't think that is the same, because that's not, now there is a work on Bayesian acquisition, Bayesian learning, that in taking place in cognitive science. That is more like what I am describing in the second half. That means look at lots of data, make certain assumptions about a priori, assumptions, and then induce from that some structure. So that is in that spirit. But they don't really look at vast amounts of data yet, cognitive scientists. The computational people in computational linguistics who are interested in applying this kind of techniques to linguistic application, language applications in the world, they really want to go after this huge amounts of data, because that is available to them every day, and want to extract as much as they can.
Yeah,
I'm motivated by that. So it's to be separated from the interests of pure cognitive scientists.
Yes, I was just having trouble sort of navigating through this. I mean, if you start with references to Chomsky and so on, and you're talking about sort of universal grammar, and you're talking about...
I went on the other side, yes.
Idealized, structured representations, whereas the PDP folks are basically talking about emergentist...
Right. Well, that is a different...
So did you have
different
to
debate,
switch
yeah.
headsets? I mean, did you...
No, I think even if you assume innate structures, you want to identify what they are. And so one question is, can we identify those by just looking huge amounts of data from outside, which is available, which was not available before. So most linguists deal with individual examples because those are the ones they can think of, without much effort. But now they cannot, they have to be, if they are responsible, they have to say, how do you explain all this other data? So I think they are getting interested in how to extract.
So it's an evolving relationship.
Evolving.
Now, but let me ask you about sort of tagging on to that, the question that you've raised as an outstanding question in cognitive science. You say, and if I may just read this, it's not hard to pose questions about language and cognition, answers we'd all like to know. These are questions about the relationship of language and other cognitive systems. It's hard to speculate what we might see some real breakthroughs, perhaps over a horizon of 25 years or longer, but I would like to pose a particular question which is related to a very important aspect of language, yet constrained enough such that we can hope to get some very insightful answers in a period of the next 10 years or so. And this is the, what is the nature of, and I need you to explain this to me, immediate discourse, ID, and the transition from sentences to immediate discourse. This is a term of art.
I introduced this term. It has some history, but I introduced in this context particularly. To identify, most linguists deal with sentences, and all computational people, psycholinguists, they all deal with sentences.
Right.
And so we know a lot about how the sentences are built. We don't really understand how we go beyond a sentence. So we have only prescriptive rules, right? Don't make a sentence too long, and one thought per sentence. I don't know what that means. But these are not really insightful ideas. So what makes us write two sentences or three sentences instead of just one sentence? So something takes us beyond the sentence. And we don't really have good accounts of these, frankly, so far. There is plenty of work on these things, but no clear. What has happened in the history of this field is that once we leave the sentence, people try to give an account of everything at once. What are the intentions of the speaker? What are their goals? What are their plans? All those things are, of course, very important. But it's too hard to give an account of the rest by just invoking these high-level concepts immediately. We don't do that at sentence level. We really, the syntax has made progress because it sort of limited itself to sentential domain. So the point is, it's been very clear now in the last 10, 15 years at least or more, that there are words in the language, these are connectives like However, because, although, nevertheless, still, you know, these are connectives that appear in the sentence, but they are, their other arguments are elsewhere in the text. You say something and then say however. Mm-hmm. So that however, one argument of however is in the sentence in which however appears, but the other argument of however is somewhere in the back. And so there is an effort now to say, well, look, these words, however, and so on, are just like verbs. They are just higher level verbs. They are taking their arguments, one in the sentence in which they appear, and another, you know, in the preceding discourse. And there are lots of these items in the language. Every language has them. But we don't understand how these connections work. So in other words, I hate to use that word, but if we could give some syntax of discourse in terms of the properties of these items, these connectives, then we will have some account of how you go from sentence beyond the sentence. That doesn't mean we understand everything about the text, about the discourse, because there are clearly some overall goals why the text was written in a certain way, certain plans or intentions of the speaker or the writer. Those are important issues. But they are true for the sentence level also. At sentence level, there are intentions of the speaker, goals of the speaker, but we sort of pull those out and don't, you know, sort of leave them on the side. So the term immediate discourse means that aspect of the structure of discourse which we can capture via the analysis of these connectives and how they connect one sentence to another in the discourse. But that doesn't mean it is everything about the discourse. So it is some immediate aspects of the structure to be distinguished from the other aspects of structure.
So there are overlaps between your mission and the one which I just discussed with Richard Schifrin, where he's talking about context of memories.
Yeah.
What you're talking about is
it is a kind of context, because the rest of the sentences are providing context for the given sentence, obviously. But it's only one kind of context. There will be, of course, other aspects of context.
So,
there is a connection there.
I can understand in his case where he says, "Look, okay, here's a memory, but now it's really important for me to know where it happened and what was going on and all the context." In the case when you say that, well, what is there beyond the sentence? If you said to me, why do you go beyond the sentence? I would say naively, well, because it wasn't long enough for me to say everything I wanted to say.
Answer we get, yes.
Yeah. So, well, what do you say when you get that usual answer?
But then you have to ask, why do we have the items like however?
However, and
instead,
yet.
Nevertheless, you know, or still. I mean, there are hundreds of these items. It's not an open-ended vocabulary. It's limited. But what is interesting is that the senses of these connectives are also constrained. So, for example, in English, since is both temporal as well as causal. You can say something since something else. So there is a causal relation between the two clauses. And it turns out that cross-linguistically, these senses are about the same. So even if two languages have very different syntactic structures at sentence level, the words that connect these connectives, one sentence to other sentences, their sense vocabulary is not open-ended. Languages seem to share that level of sense vocabulary across languages, as far as we know so far. I mean, you know, extensive work has to be done in this area. So that means what we do beyond the sentence is not completely arbitrary. It has got its own structural rules and so on.
And presumably, so presumably there's some in temporal dynamics inherent.
Yeah, sure, of course, yeah, yeah.
You know, what it made me think of just when you were saying that was something that Pascal once wrote, where he apologized for somebody if it had the time, I'd have written a shorter one. So
exactly.
So you're saying, I'm sorry I couldn't get everything into one sentence. I didn't have the temporal dynamics to organize it. So where does this in terms of the Rummelhart cohort here and the what they represent in terms of their various disciplines, activities, passions, and so on. How do you situate yourself in that group?
I found this Rummelhart quote, which was the video, strangely enough, towards the end, and I'm going to put it on my slide because it's in my style of the game. He wants to know how his course is organized. He actually says that in that. And he says it's open-ended, it's unbounded.
This is David Rummelhart.
Yeah, David Rummelhart. Yes. So that's going to be my first slide. You got the advance notice for that. And that's exactly what I mean. So what I think is happening is that the language has devices to produce a skeleton of the discourse. Okay, it isn't everything about discourse. I mean, I would be the last person to. And of course, we have now conventions of paragraphs and so on. Some of them look arbitrary when you look closely, why they are there. But let's forget about those for a while. And they only showed up in the written context. You know, spoken language also was more than one sentence.
Have all these teachers in schools drilling into kids how they should put commas and full stops and grammar and so on. And here are you saying you just want one sentence.
Well, no, not one. It's a sequence of sentences.
Yeah, it's a sort of.
But other conventions have come about, you know, so that's they sort of cloud up our, which causes problem because when you analyze texts, you don't know what to do with the paragraph, you know, boundaries.
Yeah.
How seriously you want to take them or just consider that just one text, you know. But those are technical issues, yeah.
So do you have trouble with poetry and
No, we don't do, I mean, that's...
Do you ever deal with that? And end stops and so on?
No, for fun we play with them, but that's not... The real data is the actual text and sometimes just the newswire text because those are available in lot and analyzed. But some of this work is happening now cross-linguistically and the surprising thing is that the inventory of these items, that connecting sentences, it appears to be stable across languages. Whether it is closed or partly open, can new items come in here easily? It doesn't seem to be. Historically, new items might come in, but so they're more like the closed clauses, like the articles and so on, which are fixed items. These connectives, discourse connectives, are also closed-classed items. It appears to be so, cross-linguistically. And also turns out that if I may use the word syntax, the syntax of these connectives in terms of the discourse structure, that seems to be very similar across different languages, although the sentence-level syntax is quite variable across languages. For some languages, the syntax is much more, sentence level, is much more complex than, say, English syntax. But when you look at the discourse level syntax, it appears to be about the same.
So do you derive any conclusions from these coherences across
languages?
Yeah, so
it's too, I mean, it's, you know, you can draw the conclusions. I would not publish them right now. Because we don't have enough information, enough data on this yet. But to the extent we have the data and compared, it looks like... So therefore, I think the burden is on us. Why the sentence-level syntax is so complex? It must be doing something more than what we are claiming it for right now. there are aspects of it which we don't understand, and why it varies so much across languages. But this higher level syntax, let me call it for just convenience, seems to be more similar and stable. And I'm sure, I mean, if this claim holds up, it has to have some cognitive explanation. There is no question.
Do you have any speculation about what that might be?
This is speculation, you know.
That's all right.
It may be that we see in discourse some earlier levels of syntax. It might be that language may have gone through a phase whereby you had very simple sentences and discourses made out of those. But then the sentence level syntax has become complex because it is doing a lot of work of compacting information in ways that is quite subtle. So this complexity may have come up as a subsequent step in the development of the linguistic system. But you know, this is a speculation I'm making. Do you, for this nice weather is around.
Right. Do you look at all at the communication systems of other species?
No, I mean, I read about that.
So language is not.
That is fascinating, but my knowledge is just what I read about it. I don't work.
There's about 1,000 people out here. A lot of them are younger scientists, which is nice. It's good.
Yeah.
After a distinguished career like this, which you're obviously still engaged in, I mean, do you have any advice to young scientists about the business of science?
Well, I think they should. It is happening, but it should happen more, that they have to look at some of the related fields and we know enough about them to a sufficient detail to understand why people are doing certain things in a certain way. Even though you may not choose to do it that way, but you have to really understand why they are doing it, because it's, and they're like, you know, linguists, I mean, worry about very complex things about sentence level syntax. And you may not be interested in it, but you have to know why they are worried about it, because you will have to have some explanation for that, no matter how you do it yourself. You can't just ignore that level of information. You might to do whatever else you are doing right now,
mm-hmm.
but eventually you have to face it. And so if you are exposed to it, it's always with you, and you know, you can choose to ignore it temporarily. And I think this is very, very important. And so the disciplines like computer science, linguistics, psychology, and biology increasingly, because it turned out, in my own work, we found that some of the grammatical systems mathematically which we explored can be used as a device, formal device, of explaining some folded structure of RNAs and proteins, because they are after all made up of symbols of some kind, right? Amino acids and they are, each sequence is spelled out, they are not arbitrary sequences, so they are like sentences of language in a sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you even see books entitled The Language of Life.
Right. Yeah, so. But one thing you notice is that they are, because of the physical nature of their system, they are folded. They don't appear as linear strings. In the stable state, they appear in a certain folded structures. And those are not arbitrary folds. They are, a RNA will fold in a certain way,
right,
and a certain protein will fold in a certain way. And the reason they fold is because the folding brings two items close to each other. And though they come close to each other because they share a bond, hydrogen bond in most cases. So it's like dependencies. So in linguistics also we have dependencies between words, but we draw abstract structures, okay, to show the dependencies. It's not completely bizarre to think of, but why not have a structure where dependent words are actually adjacent to each other in your representation, because they share something. What happened is that our mathematical tools have been used by the biologists to describe the folds. I've also written some papers on folding structure of folded proteins and RNAs. Uh-huh. Just applying what the mathematical tools we had for fun. I mean, we had a project for 5 years. But there is no, we don't have any neural basis of making those kinds of statements yet. But it's not, I mean, I would be the last person to say that our linguistic representations are something that we are going to find in the brain. They may be just abstractions that we don't know how. We don't have enough. Our vocabulary of representing structures is not rich enough yet inside the brain. And so eventually we'll find it. Eventually we'll be able to. But, I mean, PDP kind of things, attempts in that direction, but I don't think they are powerful enough for me to say how to represent linguistic structures there. And if I draw pictures, they are pictures to aid my thinking right now. I won't be the last person to claim that's how they are in your brain. Mm-hmm. But I can't represent them by the PDP. Now, of course, Smolensky will say that, yes, he can do both. And who knows? I mean, you know. So anyway, you're asking me why, what the students should. I think they.
Or advice to a young scientist.
They really have to look at these different related disciplines and really understand what are the hang-ups of why they are doing it in a certain way, yeah. Even if you don't decide to do it that way, because they have certain insights, and maybe some of them can be adapted to your.
But it's refreshing to hear a number of people make the similar point, which is that there has to be more of an interdisciplinary awareness of what's going on. So that I certainly hadn't thought that your tools, until you mentioned, you're talking about context-free grammars,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
CFGs,
yeah.
Being applied to the language of life, to DNA as well.
Well, more than context-free, because they can't give all the folds. So in fact, the grammars that we have used are, other people are more powerful. It has been established that you need more than context-free. So the debate has been how much more. And that's where I made some contributions to identify the space. Hopefully in that space, somewhere in that space, we have the right kind of machinery. Turns out that the grammars in that space have been turned out to be useful for modeling some complex folds. These RNA and protein folds, although context-free by themselves cannot do it. Yeah. But that may be just an accident of this mathematical device, you know, working there. But who knows?
So how did you, as you look back, how did you find yourself in this business at all? I mean, did you have parents who were interested in science? Did you have a teacher? Was there a book?
No, my father was an engineer, but I mean, I was interested in science. I sort of drifted from whatever I started with, I didn't like, so I went to something else.
But it would not be surprising. I mean,
and then I didn't like that, so I went to something else.
I mean, India and mathematics go together as well. Ramachandran keeps on insisting to me that was actually the birthplace of the zero, not other places.
That appears to be the case.
Yes.
I was interested in. I come from the era where the computers and computer science are just, beginning to mushroom. But then by coincidence, I was always interested in language also, because an Indian grammar has a long linguistic tradition, and so sort of classical tradition, and I studied that. So, but then I was at
Penn. You mean the texts like the Mahabharata and so on?
Not texts, there are grammatical texts. Panini is the ancient grammarian. It's the earliest known formal grammar in our sense. Anyway, so I happened to be at Pennsylvania, and then Zelig Harris, who was a teacher of Noam Chomsky, I saw in his course things. So I always wanted to take courses outside of what I was paying for. So I saw these interesting courses in linguistics about language structure, and so I started going there. Noam Chomsky was still visiting there from time to time. He was just finishing his work, because he did his degree with Harris. So I saw his papers, and so I got interested, and then we had this project of building this parser that Harris had just got some funds for that, and he asked me whether I would like to work in addition to my PhD dissertation, which I was doing in computer science. So I said, fine. So I worked on that along with some other people. But then, little by little, I got pulled into it. Fortunately, at Penn, both departments were quite sympathetic to this kind of activity. So that's how I ended up doing what.
How do you see this going forward over the next period within cognitive science, particular interest?
Well, for immediately
more interconnections with.
There should be more interconnection with language acquisition.
Yeah,
definitely. And I do some work with Lila Gleitman, who is very well known in language acquisition.
Yes, of course.
She's my colleague, and we have worked from time to time.
You've jointly set up the Cognitive Science Center
at
Penn?
Yeah. So she and I, we do some work jointly from time to time. So I think language acquisition is. And I think this computational acquisition of language from corpus work is influencing acquisition work also. It is also influencing historical linguistics. Now, normally you would not worry about historical linguistics in cognitive science, but you want to know what made language change, and whether there were some internal forces that were acting, or whether just historical accidents. So some of my colleagues at Penn, and of course elsewhere, are applying many of these techniques that have come from computer science and language acquisition to actually study the progression of a language through the historical corpora. One advantage they have, especially for English, where Middle English and Modern English, they have all the entire corpus in their hand. So nobody can say I've overlooked anything. So that field has been revolutionized, because people have to, all that data has been analyzed. And so if somebody comes up with a new theory, they have to validate with respect to the entire
corpus. Right.
Which is a complete change of methodology, and there is very little room for speculation, of just wild speculation. So I think this idea of change, language change, is intimately connected with language acquisition also. So I think those two fields are coming together, and I think cognitive scientists should be interested in that. But very few are interested in right now in language change.
You mentioned historical things there. If I like to ask people, if I'd be interested in your answer to this. If I gave you a time travel token, and you could use it to invite anybody to your dinner table to ask them questions, have a conversation, are there anybody that you would really like to sort of ask some questions?
Oh, from the ancient Indian times, Panini, I would like to invite, because he has the first set of rules, grammatical rules, to be applied systematically to get the structure of the, which, you know, the, even the Western linguists admit that that's the first. I would be thrilled to find out how they came up, those systems. That's just one example.
How far are we going back in time with that one?
Well, the dates of that are a little controversial, but they are certainly at least 500 BC, yeah.
That'd be an interesting little travel. If you had not done this, could you imagine there's anything else that you would have... Do you have a great passion for something else that you wished you had done?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I've gone back to India and sold some... started some restaurant in Masala Dosa or something.
Oh, really? Masala Dosa. Do you like cooking?
I like some kind of cooking, but you asked me what I might have ended up doing. Who knows?
Yeah, that's an interesting response. When he took office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. What do you think the rightful place of science is in this society?
Well, science, I don't know when politicians say that in that way. I mean, if he means support for basic research, then I understand. I think support for applied research is relatively easy to get in this country still. research, support for basic research is getting increasingly hard. I think there are signs of change again, but I think my statement is still true. So you have to sort of smuggle some of the basic research under the guise of not being irresponsible, but you have to agree to do both. Let's put it that way.
So you mean there's an emphasis on translational things?
Yeah. Out of that, a lot of basic research has come out. But the primary reason for support of that was applications.
Yes, but I mean, the obvious point is that you can't translate something if you haven't done the basic research to begin with.
So. Yeah, but it's in the case of language processing, and this may be also true for cognition, although I don't want to go beyond my expertise too much. Sometimes the push of having to do some very large tasks brings into play certain new ideas that may not come if you are just left to yourself. It has happened in the history of science. And we see some evidence of that in the machine translation work. A lot of it is highly empirical and experimental and just based on large quantities of data and information abstracted from it. But some new ideas have come out and are being tried out now, and so they might not have come out if people were just still doing their work on a small scale. So it's the scale in the kinds of applications I'm concerned with, is the scale has influenced, has produced some new techniques that we might not have considered before.
And plus the old statement about necessity being the mother of invention, I suppose. So let me ask you final question here. What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about in the direction of the work or just in general?
Answer it as you choose.
Actually, there are opportunities for really new breakthroughs in the kinds of issues I'm interested in, which the new generation has. I mean, I wish I had them all over, to put it very frankly, which I won't. But they're amazing. I mean, they just, we may be once again at the threshold of some breakthroughs. I wish I could play some role in that, but...
Well, you already
have.
You can watch with pride as things
anyway,
develop.
Anyway, I'm very optimistic about the pessimistic side is you get locked up into paradigms that very hard to shake, and they are, as usual, they are oftentimes very much controlled by the personalities involved, and so that's one of the things that the new generation has to say. Well, yes, I will listen to X, Y, Z, but keep my mind open.
Well,
not hard to do. That's hard to do. That people get, they lock themselves into the paradigm so quickly.
Well, perhaps that's the function of young scientists, is to paradigm busters.
Exactly. Well, you can't bust them too immediately. You have to learn about it and then bust it.
Well, let's visit next time and
okay.
see what has happened.
Good. Thanks. Enjoyed talking to you.